WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some Iraqi troops have retreated from the border with Kuwait, but the U.S. is going forward with its military buildup in the Gulf. Today, the U.S. started military exercises in Kuwait. My guest Fred Halliday has been following this new Gulf crisis. Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's also a contributing editor to the Middle East Report in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, also in Washington. Halliday is the author of several books on the Mideast, including Arabs in Exile. We called him earlier today at his home in London and asked if he thinks Iraq's retreat means that the crisis is over.
I doubt it. First of all, the whole issue that underlies it, namely the UN sanctions policy, Saddam's interpretation of it, the Americans' interpretation of it, that question has certainly not been resolved. And as long as there is this impasse, which really has gone on since the end of the war in early 1991, there is room for further contradictions, further conflicts. But I think even this phase of the crisis, this chapter, if you like, which may be a matter of weeks or months, is not over. Saddam took the initiative to mobilize the troops of the south. He must have known it would produce a response. So the question is, I mean, rather like looking at a chessboard, what was he hoping to do after that? And I see two possibilities. One is that he will have a crack at the north. The area in the north, which is the safe haven for the Kurds, not in good shape because it too is subject to the UN sanctions. So the economic situation is bad. There's been fighting between the Kurds. The Turks on the north of this area are getting increasingly worried about it and want it more or less wrapped up. So Saddam may try and do something against the north. I mean, he's been probing, assassinating, and so on, but he may try and do more. And that would be a much more difficult test of Western response and of Clinton's policy than the thing on Kuwait.
Why would it be more difficult?
Well, first of all, the Kuwait issue looks clear. It looks like here's an independent state which Saddam is threatening and so forth, and the people fought for it in 91. They'll fight for it again. The Kurdish area is part of Iraq. The West does not support a separate Kurdish state there. Nobody's fought for it. In fact, they've been reluctant to do so. And moreover, the Turks would not make it easy for anyone to intervene there. I think the other possibility is he'll try something diplomatic. He's been talking about recognizing Kuwait as a kind of peace offensive. And he might do it. He might play this card sometime in the next few weeks, even if it doesn't get him very far. But I've long thought that he's got another option, which would be very dramatic if he could pull it off, which would be some kind of public alliance with Iran. Up to now, he and Iran have kept shy of each other. They're both under the American so-called dual containment policy, and both have tried to wriggle out of the dual containment policy by saying, well, the other guy's worse than us. You know, Saddam said the Iranians are worse than us, the Iranians say he's worse than us. But if, as there are some indications, he's going to warm up his relation with the Iranians, they could both say, America should get out of the Gulf. We represent the majority of the peoples here. We're going to bust the embargo together. And this would have quite a detonating effect. Now, whether the mullahs in Tehran and Saddam can actually find a common ground or choose to do so, I'm not sure. But they've been hinting at improving relations. And this would be a kind of, you know, you might call it a devil's pact in the sense they hate each other. But it would certainly undercut American policy in the whole region.
So tell me more about how you interpret the motivation for, you know, Saddam Hussein's motivation for sending troops to the Kuwait border.
Well, you've got to look at it on several levels. First of all, he is very angry at the UN's maintenance of sanctions. He says, we've complied since November 1993 with the provisions of Resolution 687 on the monitoring of our weapons programs. And the UN inspector, ECIOS, has to some extent confirmed that. But of course, in saying that, Saddam is focusing everything on the military provisions of Resolution 687 and its successor, 688. And the texts are clear. There are other conditions, political conditions, such as recognizing the sovereignty of Kuwait, such as accounting for some Kuwaiti prisoners of war, 600 civilian military who got lost in the war, such as having some kind of dialogue with the political other political forces in Iraq. So by narrowing it to the military issue, he's in a sense, you know, trying to define it most favorably to him. But he's also highlighting what is a fact and is being pushed out into the open now, which is that as long as he's there, and as long as a regime like his is there, the United States is going to oppose lifting of the sanctions. And I don't personally believe they were ever going to be lifted. Whatever the French or the Russians did in the UN Security Council, they weren't going to pick a huge row with Washington for the sake of Saddam. But Saddam's made another calculation, and again, not a totally inaccurate one, which is although his prestige as the great Arab nationalist leader has declined substantially in the Middle East, basically because he lost, he blew it, in 1991, there is a lot of sympathy for Iraq. Iraq's very important Arab country. It's got a very important place in Arab history, in the history of Arab nationalism, in Arab literature, and so on. And many people in the Arab world and in Iran and Turkey feel the Iraqi people have been punished enough, whatever they think of Saddam. And in a sense, he's playing on that issue. He's got Iran says the sanctions should be lifted. Turkey says the sanctions should be lifted. The Jordanians say the sanctions should be lifted. So there is a broad sympathy there for lifting the sanctions, which he's appealed to.
You think this is a way that he can try to rally support?
Yeah, I think he can rally support. Say basically, it's the Americans' fault. Mm-hmm. And moreover, they're moving the goalposts. And of course, he says that because he's saying the argument is just about military supervision. And to be fair to the UN resolutions, they're not just about military supervision. They're about other things. But he thinks that he's made major concessions. They've not been met by the outside world. So he's got to show his own people he means business, play on regional sensibility, and also get, you know, Clinton to spend a few billion dollars flying all his troops out to the area and flying them back again. And how often is he going to wind them up and down is something which, of course, people will ask.
You know, Norman Schwarzkopf said that he thinks the explanation for Saddam Hussein's behavior is the Jimmy Carter factor, that Saddam Hussein thinks, well, if I really start acting up, they'll send Jimmy Carter down and I'll be able to get a better deal with Jimmy Carter negotiating than I will with the UN. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's U.S. domestic politics. I mean, I don't think Schwarzkopf is a politician, and he's a military man, and I don't think he knows what he's talking about any more than Ross Perot knows what he's talking about. The fact is, a lot of scorn has been, I mean, just to wrap this one, or go around this one for a moment, actually, by all accounts, talking today, Carter carried out a very significant mission in Haiti, which was cunningly done, well done, and has turned out to be successful and saved a lot of life and blood, and all power to him if that's what he did. But General Cedras is a much weaker person and a much more amenable person than Saddam. So Carter wasn't going to go to Baghdad. I mean, if Schwarzkopf had said Ramsey Clark, maybe, but Ramsey Clark, frankly, made a complete fool of himself during the Gulf War and the negotiations before it, and Carter is not Ramsey Clark. So I don't think that, I think it's denigrating what Carter tried to do. And in this case, the Americans did, I think, a much more sensible thing in Haiti than Schwarzkopf would have advised. But in this case, there's nothing to negotiate. I mean, lots of people have been to Saddam. I mean, I know people who've known Saddam for years, who've gone and seen him, who've talked to him before the war, after the war, recently. Basically, he's not listening. He's living in a fantasy world of his own, not a totally irrational one, but a fantasy world of his own. And he still thinks that, you know, he can push and push and get away with it. And in that sense, he's miscalculated. But he has some room for maneuver. And he's willing to go on doing these things as long as it takes.
How would you compare President Clinton's handling so far of the crisis in Iraq with the way President Bush handled it when Iraqi troops massed at the Kuwaiti border?
Well, at one level, the response has been much quicker, but then it was easy for it to be so. First of all, Clinton didn't have a Democratic opposition saying, don't do it. I mean, Clinton, for once, had the Republicans on his side, and the Republicans so far have not tried to make capital out of it. So the domestic U.S. political situation, the congressional situation, was much easier. Secondly, the instruments were in place. I mean, you don't need another U.N. resolution to defend Kuwait. They've got prepositioned equipment there. There's a lot of the allies are in place, although they kick and scream. I mean, the French protest, but they nevertheless send military support. Moreover, there's no need to negotiate with Saddam in terms of Western public opinion. I mean, he's denying the sovereignty of Kuwait, and people are saying, well, Kuwait's got a right. It may be an artificial state, but then so is Iraq, so it's got a right to exist, not be invaded. So in that sense, it was much easier for him. But if, going back to where we began, this particular bit of the crisis isn't over, let alone the whole story, then it's too early to say. I mean, what he does now is quite difficult. And, of course, what he does in response to what Saddam might do, another punch to the north or a diplomatic offensive or something, remains to be seen.
My guest is Fred Halliday. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Middle East expert Fred Halliday. What are the options now that the UN has?
Well, the UN could have decided to accept Saddam's interpretation of the resolutions and say he's agreeing to supervision, let's lift the sanctions, or let's do it more gradually. Let's, A, have a timetable for lifting sanctions. Say we'll start in 6 months' time. You know, Iraq could export oil up to, you know, let's say $5 billion, and then later 10, and then whatever else they can get, sort of thing, up to putative total of 15, or whatever they think they're going to get from their full oil exports. So they could have softened, but of course that's become less likely. But the long-run situation, it's a stalemate. It's been a stalemate since February the 28th, 1991. And as long as the U.S. maintains its policy with the support of many countries, including Saudi Arabia, as long as Saddam is there, it is a stalemate. And both sides are waiting for the other to crack. Well, I don't think the West is going to crack. Frankly, the West might keep on sanctions for another 20 years. After how long have they kept sanctions on North Korea or Cuba? Indeed, Saddam, looking around, might think the best way to stay in power is to have sanctions. Look how long Kim and Sung and Castro stayed in power. And on the other hand, Iraq may change. There have been several coup attempts, two at least of which I think were genuine, serious ones. Reports of others are less clear. But you can't have coup attempts every week any more than you could in Nazi Germany. And maybe, you know, the number of people willing to risk their lives has been used up. So Saddam might be there for a long time. So it's a stalemate, essentially.
This crisis is happening during the Middle East peace process. How has the peace process affected how other Arab countries are reacting to Saddam's behavior?
Well, it's a complicated question. First of all, Saddam's prestige is much lower. There's much less enthusiasm throughout the Arab world for what he's doing. I think that's important, including, by all accounts, among Palestinians, even those strongly opposed to the peace process. So there's a kind of bit of delinking taking place. Secondly, the Americans are seen by some of the conservative Arab states as having at least delivered on part of what they promised back in 1990-91. I would say, not to be misunderstood, but the part of the historic credit, not the moral credit, but the historic credit for getting the Arab-Israeli peace process goes to Saddam. He gave everyone a big shock, including the Israelis. I mean, I think Israeli self-confidence has been eroded by a number of things. The Intifada is one thing. I think before that, very not to be forgotten, the war in Lebanon in 1982, and they realized they couldn't just do everything they wanted to do. But having missiles rain down on you and having to all resort to wearing gas masks and so on is something which I think hit the Israeli population. I mean, they realized they have military superiority, but they have to, you know, they have to deal with a security threat that can't be dealt with by purely territorial acquisitions.
Jordan has condemned Iraq's aggressive behavior. The PLO is not supporting Saddam Hussein. Do you think that that Jordan and the PLO would have been reacting in the same way if it weren't for the Middle East peace process?
No, I think, I mean, to put it very harshly, Jordan and the PLO have got Saddam from Saddam what they wanted. Namely, he gave the United States a kick in the backside and got it to finally do something about this Arab-Israeli peace process and gave them a real fight. And so Iraq hasn't benefited, but others have. And secondly, they realize that Saddam, while he may have had some right on his side or some arguments on his side in 1990, has much less now. And also Jordan can see trouble coming. I mean, one of the problems Jordan has, and Kuwait has, everybody has, and most of all the people of Iraq have, is what comes after Saddam. I mean, the country's being run down in a very drastic way, and that will greatly accentuate the problems thereafter. And if you're on the frontier, as Jordan is, and if much of your economic livelihood is dependent upon trade with Iraq, then this is a serious consideration. So King Hussein, I mean, played the 1990-91 crisis very shrewdly, but he is pretty fed up with Saddam now, and I think has made that clear. And he's another one of the people who's been to Saddam and said, come on, you know, shape up, the world isn't like this, we can help you out of this, and Saddam hasn't listened to him.
How has Saddam Hussein managed to stay in power?
By shooting people. I think it has to, I mean, one of the arguments, you know, that came up during the last Gulf War was, why should we defend Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, which are dictatorships just like Saddam? But, I mean, it's a gruesome thing to do, but if you quantify human rights violations or have any criteria of relative tyranny or dictatorship, there's no comparison between even a pretty grotesque conservative state, particularly for women, like Saudi Arabia and Iraq. I mean, Saddam has murdered hundreds of thousands of his own people. He's gassed them. He's destroyed 8,000 villages. I mean, one just has to look. You read cold-bloodedly the annual reports of Amnesty International. There is no comparison between the human rights record of Saudi Arabia and the human rights record of Iraq. And he has maintained in power in that way. Secondly, he has a clique of people around him from his own area, who are enough of the population to staff the key military units. For a long time, he had oil, which he spent in a quite shrewd political way. And people were frightened. They were frightened of Iran. I mean, one of the whole paradoxes of the story is that when they were in a war with Iran for 8 years, and Iran appealed to Muslim rebellion in Iraq and so on, the Iraqi people rallied to Saddam, and they rallied on the basis of what one could call, very roughly, an Iraqi patriotism, which many people had doubted was there. But when Saddam went into Kuwait and was driven out by the Americans, the Iraqi people didn't rally to him. They rose up in an insurrection in which many, many more people were killed than were killed in the war with the Americans in 1991. So he's lost a lot of that support. But people I've talked to come from Iraq are still frightened about what will happen afterwards. Will they just fall apart like Afghanistan or Lebanon or Somalia? But the main thing is fear and terror. And I remember when I was in Iraq meeting somebody who said to me, as a kind of joke, but it wasn't, he was an academic, he said, you know, when I open the newspapers in the morning, I don't know if I will have been nominated ambassador to the UN or sentenced to death. And in either case, I wouldn't know why. And I think, you know, the arbitrary executions are continuing, but if you're prepared to be tough enough and if you have enough of a group of people around you, it's very hard to be displaced. And the fact is, the Iraqi people did rise up in 91, North and South, Arab and Kurds, Sunni and Shia. There were vast mutinies in the army in the South. He crushed them. And people won't try it again, likely, inevitably.
Saddam Hussein recently instituted the Islamic punishment of cutting off a hand for theft, and he warned deserters from the armed forces that they risked losing both ears.
Yes, this is, I mean, there's several aspects of this. One is that he is and has been trying to deck himself out in Islamic garb by claiming to be a descendant of the Prophet and he's planning now to build a huge mosque in Baghdad. Even while his people are starving, he's ordered $25 million worth of marble from Italy and all the rest of it. But, I mean, nobody really believes that he has Islamic legitimacy. In that sense, it's a forlorn activity. But this thing of physical executions is part of his belief that if you want to rule a country, you should rule it harshly. He's not only said that, he said that doctors who refuse to carry out these amputations will themselves have the amputations performed on them that they've refused to perform on others. In other words, if you're a doctor and you're told to cut off the ears of a deserter and you don't do it, then you'll have your own ears cut off. And I remember once arguing with a leading member of Saddam's party, and I said, you know, why are you so cruel? Why do you kill and torture so many people? And he didn't say what people in many countries say was, we're not doing it, this is imperialist lies. He said, yes, we do it. We do kill and torture people, but we have to. He used the Arabic word giswa, meaning harshness. You need al giswa to run a country like Iraq, to make it a great nation, and Saddam really believes that.
Do you think Iraqi expansionism is a threat to Middle East peace?
Well, Iraqi expansionism has been a threat to two other Muslim countries, namely Iran, whom he attacked in 1980, and Kuwait, which he attacked in 1990. It's possible that he could one day, if he was able, have a crack at Syria. And it's also possible that he'd gobble up Jordan, but I don't think he'll get the chance to do either of those things. I don't think that Iraq's policies are capable of scuppering the Arab-Israeli peace negotiations. I think they have other problems, which we've seen in the last few days. But I mean, I know what's wrong with the Arab-Israeli peace negotiation, and anybody, Israeli or Palestinian, will tell you what's wrong with them. And it's in particular, they've keeping the Palestinians under a very tight and in many ways humiliating control. But I'm still of the view, which I know many critics of the agreement in the Middle East and in the United States are not, I'm still of the view that this is a positive development. It can be made to go forward, although it'll be stopped on occasion, and that people who are broadly sympathetic to a kind of understanding between Palestinians and Israelis should try and push it forward. I do not think one should go around denouncing and carping this agreement, as quite a lot of sincere, but in my view, misguided and actually irresponsible Arab and American intellectuals have done over the last two or three years. I just don't think that's a very positive contribution to actually helping the Palestinians. So I think the thing is running, albeit in a very messy way. I was in Israel in June and talked to a lot of Palestinians and Israelis when I was there. I must say the most encouraging thing of all was talking to settlers, because Israeli settlers, because they all thought they were finished. I mean, their only hope was if Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria, refused to do a deal on the Golan, and then Rabin would fall, and then the Likud, the right-wing party, would come to power and the peace process would be over. But, I mean, everybody was complaining, and the Palestinian complaints, both vis-a-vis the Israelis and vis-a-vis Arafat, perfectly understandable. But the fact is something had changed, and I think it should be taken forward. And so far, it's kept on moving, if in an odd way. There are immense problems, but let's have the problems of peace rather than the problems of total hatred, genocide, and refugee status and all the rest of it.
Do you think Arab countries are really reconciled to the existence of Israel?
I've been traveling in the Arab world for more than 20 years, and I am struck. I'm struck every day by the shift in attitude, whether it's at the level of what you read in newspapers or what political leaders say, or just the way people talk about Israel. I mean, they're critical of Israel, they disagree with it, they say that it's been indulged by America, and so on, but they talk about it as if it's another country in the region. They don't like Israel, there'll always be problems, but I think we're in a totally different situation from what we were in 5, 10, 15 years ago. That stalemate has broken, and among Palestinians also, and people are saying, how do we live with this state, rather than how do we get rid of it? And that's a huge shift, and I think a very positive one.
Fred Halliday, he's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics and a contributing editor of the Middle East Report. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.